Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. My name is Darius Bassefi, producer and host. Today, my guest is James Cook from a company called JLL. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Darius. It's great to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you for joining me. So why don't you do a proper intro?
So I'm a retail researcher. I lead JLL's North America retail research. And so that is really about physical retail space. So shopping centers, high streets, malls, grocery stores, all of that stuff my team does research about. I like to say that our job is to think about the future of retail and retail real estate. And JLL is just a global property services company. So we manage in the retail world, we manage shopping centers, we help retailers open stores, we design stores. And then we also do lots of stuff in office and industrial, and we're kind of all over the place when it comes to commercial real estate.
The way I found out about you is your podcast. Everybody's asking, what's the future of the shopping center? It's a very big question, very complex.
When we use the term shopping center, there's actually a couple of different categories that go into that. So there's the, you know, what you would call like the daily needs center, which might have a grocery store or a, you know, a drug store. And those, through the pandemic, foot traffic was through the roof. We actually saw historically for the past, I'm going to say 5 or 6 years, Americans now were spending more on eating out than they were at the grocery store, and the pandemic hit and that totally flipped. And you know, for that, say 12-month period, Americans were again spending more at the grocery store, and that's really where they were going. It was a grocery store, Walmart, Target, and then everything else was online. So those places were dealing with unprecedented foot traffic and unprecedented online orders. People, you know, clicking, you know, buy online, pick up in store, grocery stores like they'd never seen before. So the future for those centers is kind of dealing with this new reality, this new omnichannel reality, where a lot of shoppers are now expecting the center to be designed in such a way where they can quickly get in and pick up the online orders. And the stores themselves have had to be redesigned in order to fulfill those online orders. But then you have enclosed malls, and they've really suffered through the pandemic. There's just no way around it. People just weren't going to the mall. Since restrictions have been lifted and people have started to feel safer, we've seen foot traffic really start to recover at the enclosed malls, but the pandemic revealed this huge disparity. I'm sure you've heard a lot of department stores closed. Some retailers went bankrupt. If you own a not great mall and you now have a huge vacant, say 100,000 square feet of space, you might not be able to find anybody to lease that space. So now you've got a corner of your mall that's completely dead. Now, if you own what we call an A mall, which is the good malls that have, you know, you're in an A mall if it's got, say, a Tesla dealership or an Apple store or a Williams Sonoma. If you're in an A mall and you lose a department store, you know what? You can figure out something to do with it. Maybe you put in a food hall, a restaurant, you know, some new cool internet, you know, digital native concept. There's ways to use that space. So it's not the death of the mall by any means, but what's happened because of COVID is a total bifurcation where we've got just a handful of these great A malls that I think are just chugging along and recovering quite nicely. And then what we would call like a C mall, which is now really struggling.
The downtrend to the large malls is not new. It just got accelerated. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a trend we've been seeing for, boy, I want to say maybe 15 years now, but it's been a slow burn and the pandemic just clicked it into high gear. And, you know, we just saw all these bankruptcy announcements, all these announced, you know, especially the department stores. Those are the toughest closures for malls to handle because, you know, we call them anchors because they really do anchor the traffic to the mall and create it for what it is. And honestly, malls going forward, they're going to have to reinvent what that anchor is, because you don't, there's not going to be a need for, say, three or even two department stores often in a mall. So you got to figure out what's going to be that new draw of foot traffic of shoppers.
Talk a little bit about technologies that you see being used in the malls that are more successful.
The model of the mall was invented in the 1950s and really hasn't changed all that much. Sort of, you know, there's been a haphazard approach to testing out technologies. Now, many mall owners are very forward looking and are experimenting with all kinds of different stuff. And you're going to see that most, again, I'm going to use this term, a mall. The best malls are the places where they have the capital to experiment and invest in new technologies. And you can see that in a variety of different ways, even from parking technologies, you know, installing sensors and parking structures so that you could look on an app and see where the open spaces are in the parking structure at the mall, or you know, there'll be a digital sign at the entrance that says where you can go to park. Little things like that, you know, having wayfinding within the mall using an app, something a little bit better than that traditional static store directory that everybody's standing around looking at. One of the interesting ones is Mall of America, which is one of, if not the kind of top U.S. mall. It's certainly in terms of foot traffic, it's one of the biggest biggest destinations, at least in the Midwest. The Mall of America is experimenting. They just partnered with a company called Adept Mind. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they basically, the Mall of America website is now also a shoppable e-commerce website where you can both see the inventory, like of what products are in all the stores. You can also buy that inventory for either click and collect, like you can buy it and then go to the store and pick it up, or pick it up in front of the mall, or buy it for delivery. Will they do a ship from store? And that's really, that component has always been missing. So the fact that they're figuring out how to do that, I think that can be really successful.
So the malls are getting into e-commerce?
Starting to, yeah, a handful. Adept Mind, and I think there's another company that's also offering this as a service to malls. I'm sure there's some fee involved that's part of the marketing budget of the mall. But yeah, in essence, say I'm looking for a pair of jeans, I can search the mall website in advance to see all the stores that have jeans in my size and what the styles are. So I'm really now very purposefully driven, and I know exactly what I'm going to find at the mall.
How does that play into the financial arrangement of leases?
That's a great question. So that sale, let's say I search for jeans and they're Lucky Jeans. That's a jeans brand, right? And so if I said, okay, I'm going to go buy jeans from Lucky, if I just go into the mall and buy them there, the ones that I found, obviously that sale goes to Lucky. If I buy it through the website, it's still a sale to Lucky Jeans because I'm doing a click and collect where I'm going to pay for it in advance and then go pick it up at the mall, or they'll do ship from store. And that's done centrally. I think the way it works is, you know, the jeans store wouldn't ship it themselves. There's somebody who works with the mall doing that fulfillment, you know, in some centralized location. So there's a cost around that. The sale goes to the retailer. And then I believe, and don't quote me on this because I don't know exactly how it works, but my guess is that there's some kind of monthly fee that goes to the service provider who's offering that click and collect service. And I would imagine the cost of that gets folded into the marketing budget for the mall, and that would get paid ultimately by the tenants.
How does that work into the brand recognition of the retailer versus the mall itself long-term? Is the customer becoming more loyal to the mall or to the brand? Is the mall becoming the next online marketplace?
If you asked a mall owner, they would like that, you know, they would like, and some malls, you know, I think about, for example, where are you based out of?
Orange County, California.
Okay. Okay. So let's think about in LA, like the Grove. Like the Grove in LA, very popular, very well known, if not just regionally, but probably a lot of people not outside of LA. And that's its own brand. And, you know, or speaking of brand, Americana at brand, you know, like those, those are both Caruso properties that are their own unique brand. And people don't go to, well, they go to specific stores when they say go to the Grove, but a lot of times you're just going there to go there. If you've got a good collection of both food and shopping and entertainment, and you're not really sure what you want to do on a Friday night, but you know that this one place has a collection of cool things and you'll find something, then that's when branding is really important. And that's what distinguishes, I'm going to go back to this A malls. That's what distinguishes the A mall. They have the brands. It's the B mall that's a collection of stores that's exactly like every other mall, you know, that there it is the individual store brands that really count at those B malls.
The question which remains to be seen, but based on how we see things play out, is that the difference between the physical experience and the digital experience. So physical experience, yes, I go to the mall and it is an experience. But when I go to the website of the mall, it's just like Amazon. The physical experience aspect of the mall, which is so important, is really lost when you go online and to just a e-commerce website. How does that translate to the future?
It's a great question. I mean, I think most malls would love at least to have their websites be as good as an e-commerce website, because most malls' websites are like a list of stores and like the store hours and their phone numbers. And then they'll be like, I don't know. Most mall websites are pretty basic. So just to get to that level where you can do similar things to e-commerce websites and just have visibility to inventory, to the inventory of the stores at the mall, that's pretty awesome. Now to your question of how do you distinguish yourself online when you're just like every other e-commerce website? I don't know if you can do it. I think you're really distinguishing yourself by your physical space. I think that's what distinguishes you. Because I wouldn't, I mean, the reason why I would shop online for a mall is that if I knew it was in my neighborhood and I knew I could get that item in an hour, that's why I would do it. So it's that physical location that distinguishes it.
Right. So for customers, the reason they shop online or they select where to shop online is probably the product selection, price, and access to inventory now, which is becoming actually more, you know, with the supply chain issues, having local inventory is like really important these days. And might remain to be so for the next at least couple of years. So, you know, hopefully things get better. So I think that's like one of the questions. And I mean, in general, malls, shopping centers, they are selling traffic. Is that a good, really high level, value proposition for a retailer that, you know, they just want traffic, right? That's why they go to the mall. It's a different type of traffic, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I mean, at the end of the day, what you're doing is selling feet walking in front of your store. And then you as a retailer have to convert those feet first to people that walk through the door and then into sales. I mean, the metric, it's still old fashioned, but the metric we use in the mall world is sales per square foot. So the higher a sales per square foot that you've got at a mall, the more rent you can charge as the owner of that mall, because not only do you have large foot traffic, but you've also got people who are spending a lot of money. So it's two things. It's the people and then the cash that they're spending. And that's how we're going to judge sort of the success of the mall. But that can change. I mean, if you think about a future where stores become more for branding than for sales, we're going to have to come up with new metrics. You know, if you learn about my cool electric scooter brand at a store at the mall, but then you buy it online, it's still very valuable because you learn about it by seeing it in person at that mall.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole other side of what's going on is how the retail stores are changing. And we, you know, I guess, are we going towards the Tesla model of retail stores where you just see and touch things in the store and then you get it delivered later? That's an interesting, interesting concept. I mean, if you look at that model, a lot of like direct to consumer brands are trying that and Tesla, but it hasn't like really exploded yet. So the question is how is that going to evolve in the future? And as a consumer, what's a better experience for you? Like if you go to a store and you want to buy eyeglasses and you can just look at them and you can actually pick one up, is that a better experience or a worse experience than like, you know, so what's, as a consumer, what's better? I know what's, so a lot of times what I hear right now is that what's good for the retail to make the retail store formula work better. But the success of online shopping is that they thought about what's good for consumers first, not what's good for the e-commerce website. I mean, if you go to Amazon, consumer is the number one concern that they have. It's not like, you know, what's good for me. So when retailers and shopping centers really should think about what's good for the experience of the consumer.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, I think there's a happy medium there between just pure showroom, which irks me sometimes because I've been in a couple of situations where I just want to grab something at a store. One I'm thinking of is I want to buy a belt. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're just a showroom. You can try it on, but then you're going to have to buy it online and we're going to mail it to you. And I'm like, I need this belt like now, right? So that seems silly to me. It also seems silly to me to have this super big box as warehouse that has a million things. That just seems unnecessary. So there's like a happy medium there where they're carrying enough goods on hand that most of the time you can walk away with what you want. But there's, you know, maybe different sizes and models that are less popular that now they can fulfill that online. So I think more people are happy. You get the most people happy that way.
Yeah, I think that the happy medium is a good goal to work towards. One of the other things that I've seen is, you know Dick's Sporting Goods. And so what happened a few years ago is that most of the local sporting stores closed except Big Five. So, and I mean, I'm in sports and I love going to the store and touching things. I want to buy a racket. I want to do this. I buy stuff online too, but that experience of going to the store is just different. And I was like kind of pissed off myself that everybody's closing. I can't even go pick up like racquetball balls just if I need them on my way to the game or something. I have to order them online and wait for them all the time. So now Dick's Sporting Goods is that massive store and they are opening up all over the place in Southern California. They're filling that gap. And I don't know how they're doing, but like in a mall that's really close to me, shops at Mission Viejo, which is a Simon mall, they just replaced probably one of the bigger anchor, like, you know, used to be Saks, then Forever 21 took it, and now Dick's is over there. And it's a much better fit for that space, in my opinion. So that could be the other, there could be like two extremes of really large, have everything you need, just go there type of experience. And then it's just a showroom type of experience. And what remains to be in the middle is kind of interesting.
Yeah, what's unique about Dick's too is that it's not really, it's a collection. That store's really a collection of small categories. So like I'm a runner. So when I go to Dick's, I'm not looking at all of Dick's. I'm just going to this, like looking at this one selection of shoes and this one selection of like running clothes, you know? So, you know, if I played baseball, I'd be looking at this one small area. So I think Dick's is unique in that sense that I don't really think of it as a huge warehouse with every SKU across sporting goods. I think that they do have a pretty good collection organized around a whole variety of different sporting activities.
Yeah, it's almost like the concept of the theoretical marketplace, right? Where you go and you have different stores. And even like retail stores are testing that, like with Target, bringing in other retailers or brands to have their own stores, which is kind of interesting too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Target's done a few partnerships. They've got a number of Disney store-in stores that have been really popular. And then Ulta is the big one. And I think that's going to really knock it out of the park, because oftentimes I see the Target shopper also cross-shopping to Ulta. And the fact that now that's available right within the Target store, not the same size, not the same amount of selection, but having that there available, I think it's great. And that whole concept of store in stores has really kind of, it's been bubbling up a lot, I would say, over the past like maybe 10 years or so. But we've seen a lot more of it just recently, with kind of retailers wanting to grab onto other popular brands and pull people into the store as a draw.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about, you know, customer acquisition costs, right? CAC. What do you shop? Do you advertise, you know, on paid advertising? You do, you know, like organic content, and then partnerships. These are all like partnerships that I think you have to pay for customer acquisition costs one way or another. The question is, how do you do it and how do you minimize it? And where do you get the customer that can actually build out to be a long-term, like more loyal? Because one of the problems with online is that customers are just not loyal.
Right.
It's very hard to get the loyalty. I mean, some companies do really good, maybe like Amazon with loyalty programs and, that's the holy grail, is how do you get your customers at a cost and quality? And I think the same goes with shopping centers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if the barrier of entry is low, and you've got a ton of choice, so that's shopping online. But the barrier of entry in the physical world, in the real estate world, is very high. And, you know, it's difficult for there to be so much competition. Also, the physical location of a store actually helps to earn that brand's loyalty for me. Like, if there could be two stores and one is awesome and one's just okay, but the just okay one is 20 minutes closer to me, they may have earned my loyalty just out of my laziness. I guess my point here is, I don't think the value of having a physical store network for retail brands is going away. I think that it just plays such an important role in, like, I don't know too much about e-commerce. I'm really more based in the physical world, but I know that customer acquisition cost, that's got to be higher online, right, than it is in the physical world.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the physical side to to make that determination myself. But that's actually one of the things that I deal with in my business right now, is that we work with shopping centers and retailers to bring a different form of online shopper to them, using with live video. It's private live video. It's not like one to many, like QVC style. It's private one-on-one live video sales. And that, the point of customer acquisition cost is really important for the mall, the shopping center. And that's something that I'm actually learning more about. So I don't know I don't think they even measure it. I don't think shopping centers. So that's like one of the things I was going to talk about, is like, other than technology, there are other things like experiences of the staff and the teams that they have that really need to get upgraded with shopping centers. Like their marketing, which is really important for acquiring new customers and building the loyalty for them, really, they need to become more like online marketers. So they pay a lot more attention to these metrics, like looking at analytics and looking at where the traffic is coming. Because traffic is really two ways now. It's not just foot traffic in the store, it's also online traffic. So they need to expand to look at traffic in both ways. So that's like a very, I mean, really good question. And I personally don't know enough about the mall side, but it is something that I'm interested to learn more about is what are malls? So A malls, as you said, probably are doing a lot better in that.
Is right.
Getting
well,
better in marketing. Yeah.
So I have very good, I have very sophisticated tools around foot traffic. So I can see, you know, where people are coming from, not individuals, but in aggregate. You know, for example, if a lot of people are coming from one neighborhood to a mall or to even a certain store at a certain time, I can see those flows. What I can't see is if somebody learned about something online and then came to check it out in the store, like that connecting the dots. Even the best malls, I don't think are doing that because I just don't know. I don't think anybody's figured out how to do it.
Well, you know, we probably need something like a physical pixel.
Yeah. Or something. Right. Right. And that is, it's interesting because there is a big debate around, you know, just privacy, especially you're based in California, very strict privacy laws there. And I'm in favor. I like marketing information, but I'm also very much a privacy advocate. So there's got to be a happy medium there too. So all the data that I work with is very aggregated. I don't see any individual information, but yeah, I don't know. Or you can use a panel of people who've opted in and you pay them for their personal information as a sample set. I don't know, but it's a great question as to where your traffic is coming from. As a mall owner, you really need to be aware of that and be thinking about it.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, the other part of it is the question about leases. A lot of, like, especially in probably the A mall, leases have an aspect of revenues in them, right?
It depends, but most mall leases do have a percentage component to it. So basically there's a base rent. That's kind of the minimum rent that you're going to pay. And I should say, this is for inline tenants. This does not apply to the anchor tenants. There's a different structure there. Okay. But for the inline tenants, you're going to pay a base rent and then a percentage of sales once you hit what they call a break point. So your sales get to a certain number that's been pre-negotiated between the tenant and the landlord. And when it gets beyond that, then you're paying a small percentage of those sales as a part of your rent. Because of that, landlords have really good visibility to what many of their tenants are doing. And so they can see, they have to report their sales month to month. And so landlords often have great data around, you know, just month to month, how every individual retailer in their center is doing. And it's interesting information. The question is, like, how do you act on that? How do you make that actionable?
Yeah, and then how does a showroom store play into that?
That's right. So that's the other thing is, and we've been dealing with that for a number of years now too. And in those cases, it's just got to be market rents. It's got to be you're going to negotiate a flat rent with the landlord, and that's the only way to do it. We've had many discussions about, well, you know, if you could figure out how many, whatever the metric is, like if you added so many people to your mailing list, or if we could track what sales of, say, goods were originated in that store. But a lot of these stores are just pure branding plays, and there's not even a sale associated with them. There's no way to have a rent tied to that. And so in those cases, it's really just you're going to negotiate a monthly rent with your between the retailer and the landlord.
Yeah. And then, you know, for like the BOPIS, buy online, pick up in store, you are buying online, but you're taking the inventory from the store. So whose sale is that? And does that have to go to the, you know, that formula?
So that all has to be, you know, that discussions around that all have to be negotiated as a part of the leases now. And in most cases, the landlord's going to argue, Well, you made that sale because of your physical store. So it should be attributed to the store. Most cases that is happening where those sales are attributed to the store. Now, conversely, a lot of times people will return online items to physical stores. Traditionally, that's gone as a negative against that store's four-wall revenue. But there's a good argument to be made against that because now the landlord might be losing rent because, you know, I'm buying 100 shirts online and then returning them all to this one store. So it's an open discussion. In most cases, there aren't national standards around this. It's like landlords are kind of figuring it out for themselves.
Yeah, that's one of the changes in the reinvention of the shopping center is on the financial formula. So, let's talk a little bit about what you do in your daily work. Maybe give us some examples of some of the work that you do and how it translates into JLL.
Sure. So in the kind of the retail world of JLL, which is my little world, we make our money by helping retailers find store locations. So a national retailer says, hey, we want to open up 5 new stores in Chicago. We're going to go find those stores for them. Conversely, we also manage and lease malls and shopping centers. So say you own a mall, but you don't want to deal with it. We'll go in as a third party, manage the mall for you, and lease out the spaces. So we're going to go find local and national retailers to fill out those spaces. And then we also help people buy and sell properties. So if you owned, say you own a grocery center and you want to sell it, we would be the ones who would handle that marketing and the sale of that property. And so in all of those different businesses, I play a supporting role. And it could be, you know, for example, there might be a local or regional restaurant chain that is thinking about going national. And so I'll go in with a meeting with them and come up with some metrics that we think represent their best customers. And then we'll look at national markets and flag which national markets we think they should take a closer look at for their expansion. And we may even, you know, we may even tier them and say, here's the first 3 cities you should go to, here's the next 3. And then once you dive in at the city level, then it's, you start talking about neighborhoods. And so there's a whole expansion plan around that. So that's with retailers, with shopping centers. I'm trying to think of different stuff we've done. There is a company, yeah, this is public, I can talk about this. There's a company called Phillips Edison, Pico, and they own, I want to say, about 300 shopping centers. They're mostly grocery anchored centers in the US, and they went public. So they were privately owned and they just went public. And so I was part of a research team that did all of the third party analysis of their portfolio that went into their SEC findings. So basically benchmarking the performance of their centers against all of their competitors. So this is getting a little in the weeds. This isn't as exciting. It's a bunch of data. You know, there's probably like 5 analysts in the world that actually read what we wrote, but you know, it was a public filing. So we were really excited about it.
Those 5 mattered.
Yeah. But I would say the most fun thing that I do is, you know, I say my job is to think about the future of retail. And we have a lot of clients who all want to hear about what's going on across the retail spectrum. And so I do a lot of one-on-one meetings with clients, both in person and over Zoom. And then I do a lot of speaking at events too. So I'm sort of the public face of retail research at JLL. And conferences were on pause, but they're starting back up again. I was at a conference 2 weeks ago speaking. I've got 2 more coming up through the end of the year. I'm pretty excited. And then of course we do podcasts and we also do a weekly live stream video as well. So there's a good strong marketing component to what I do.
Yeah. I mean, you're busy. That's great.
I'm like, oh, that's why I'm tired all the time. I just describe stuff that I do and it's too much.
Yeah, if you go back and listen and make a list, you'll understand why.
Yeah.
So talking about the conferences, what's the one that you just went to?
Okay, yeah, fun. It was called Grocery Shop. And
in Vegas, right?
In Vegas. Yeah, and it was apart from excellent content, learned a lot, was there to speak about mostly about how the physical grocery store is changing. And a good chunk of that is about how they're reconfiguring for buy online, pickup in store. So I was there to speak, but also there as an attendee to learn. It was cool. Everybody was in a mask, which was weird because I didn't recognize anybody. I don't have great eyesight to begin with. And that made it all the more difficult, especially when these are people you probably haven't seen in person for a few years now. But overall, it was a very positive experience. You had to be vaccinated in order to attend, so I felt pretty safe about it.
Okay. So that's one of the big questions of, you know, as we get back to whatever normal is, is the physical in-person conferences. What do you think about, what are some of the big ones that you're going to, are you planning for ICSC in December, right?
Yeah. So for folks not familiar with our little shopping center world, ICSC is the trade group and their big conference, annual conferences in Las Vegas. Traditionally, it's been in March. Yeah, March. And got canceled, of course, because of COVID. And so they're doing a smaller kind of let's get back to Vegas one in December. I want to say historically that conference would hit like 30,000 attendees. I don't know what their numbers are going to be, but my guess is probably they'll at least do like 10 or 15,000. Like I'm talking to people. It sounds like a lot of people are going.
Okay. Yeah. So that's an interesting one that I've heard about. I've never been there, but I'm looking into going there. And then NRF, what do you think about NRF in January?
Yeah. And that's retail's big show. That's the big one. I don't typically go to NRF because my world is kind of this hybrid of retail and real estate. So I'm gonna usually go where there's a physical, there's an orientation towards like physical retail. It's changing now, it's all hybrid. So I'd probably benefit from going to NRF. Yeah, I think that, you know, that's the big one. And if that is successful, you know, in January, I mean, that's going to be a real return to kind of the conference world.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it is expectations. You know, if we expect that we're just going to be back to what it was before, I think we'll all be disappointed. And I think that's, we just need to reset our expectations and say, you know, we're slowly getting back into it. And if we look at it from that point of view, I think we'll definitely have a better experience.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I agree. I think we did have this illusion where everything was going to get back to exactly the way it was. And that's just not the case. And I think resetting your expectations is definitely the healthy way to go.
So let's talk a little bit about your podcast and your YouTube. What's your experience doing those? And are you finding, what's interesting that you didn't expect before you started to do these things?
Yeah. So the two major outlets is the podcast called Where We Buy. And that's on whatever podcast app you might want to check out. It's also on the web at wherewebuy.show. And then we do a weekly live video for half an hour every Thursday at noon Eastern. That's 9 Pacific. And we go live on YouTube and we also go live on LinkedIn Live simultaneously. And if you go to everythingweknow.show, that'll take you to the page on YouTube. So the podcast, the audio podcast, has been around longer. We're almost at 200 episodes now. And that started out as a pure experiment, like me recording, talking into my iPhone for 5 minutes, you know, just pure experiment. And it's evolved into a I don't think I've ever said this to anybody, but I'll tell you what, in my mind, I'd love it to be considered, you know, the radio show Fresh Air on NPR. I want it to be the Fresh Air of retail and retail real estate. That's a little secret. I've never told anybody.
Hey, you're almost there. When I listen to it, the quality and the production is very good.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you. Yeah. So anyway, in-depth stories. And what I've learned that I didn't expect is it's really helped me to grow connections with people. I've always loved talking to people, and a podcast is a great excuse, as you know, to talk to people. That's what I love about it most. The other weird thing is that I think no one listens to it. Of course I see the numbers, so I know a handful of people do, but then I'll go to like a conference like ICSC and I've had people hear my voice and say, "Oh, are you James Cook?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know you." And they like recognize my voice and be a fan of the show, which is weird, but cool. I mean, it also makes me realize I'm glad I'm not famous, because I'd hate to have that happen all the time, but it's neat if it happens occasionally.
Right, right. Well, I put a link to both of those in the show notes. I think they're good, and I haven't seen the YouTube one yet, so I'm looking forward to put that on my calendar and hopefully join when I can. So, well, thank you so much, James. It's been a pleasure to speak with you and learn from your experience, and look forward to continuing our conversations maybe in the future.
Thank you very much, Darius. This has been fun.